Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Thanks to Sarah Gonzalez filling in while I took a couple of days off on Thursday and Friday. And here's a question. In an America First government, can the Secretary of State be someone more accustomed to putting his company first? I'm talking about Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, who several media reports say is about to be named Secretary of State by President-elect Donald Trump. And maybe he'll be great. Who knows? But we have to ask this question. Because, for example, here is journalist Steve Call from The New Yorker on All Things Considered yesterday. He's the author of the 2012 book Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power.
ExxonMobil is a very large corporation that really sees itself as an independent sovereign in the world. It has revenue the size of the economy of South Africa. It operates all over the world negotiating with leaders on behalf of its shareholders. It's kind of a parallel quasi-state. And so it raises all kinds of questions about how someone like Tillerson, who of course I assume is a patriotic, loyal American, nonetheless he spent all of his life negotiating on behalf of Exxon's interests, which are not always the same as the interests of the United States.
Not always the same as the interests of the United States. Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And of course, it's not a new thought that major multinational corporations see themselves as beyond the system of nation states. Patriotism toward any one of those countries would not necessarily be their first loyalty. But it's rare that somebody in that position is being considered for Secretary of State of the country. We'll talk to NPR's Mara Liasson in just a second about the possibility of Tillerson as Secretary of State and other transition news. But if the CEO of ExxonMobil is really going to be the Secretary of State, as these media reports say he is, I thought you might like to hear Rex Tillerson in his own words a little bit. This is not a gotcha clip. It's just Tillerson at work, acting like the Secretary of State for his company, with its own interests and its own relationships with governments around the world. This is from an interview on CNBC, the Business Channel, in March, and it starts with Tillerson talking about the Iran nuclear deal, not in terms of U.S. national security, but in terms of ExxonMobil's financial interests as doing business in Iran becomes legal again under the Obama deal.
We would certainly take a look. Okay. Because it's a huge resource-owning country.
That brings us to a lot of the instability that's been out there in places like Saudi Arabia and places like Russia. How do you measure things just in terms of a global risk factor right now, and where would you say we are?
Well, geopolitical risk is just a way of life for us. It has been my whole career. And it changes, and the nature of it changes. We've been through wars. We've been through revolutions. We've been kicked out of countries. We've gone back to countries. It is very country by country specific. I would say there is a lot of uncertainty in the world today, certainly in the big producing regions, the Middle East, the relationship with Russia. And those are enormously important parts of the world for everyone's economies. And this is, energy is the lifeblood to economic growth. Hopefully, things will work themselves out. Middle East is a tough place right now. A lot of wars on multiple borders that people are having to deal with. We continue to work successfully there in spite of that and have very good open relationships with the governments there.
His company has open relationships with governments. Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO on CNBC in March. As reports say, he will be named Secretary of State. Let's talk about that and other transition news with NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll come back to Tillerson and talk about all that. But first, can you explain the story of the CIA position that Russia tried to influence the election? Trump and his aides were on television casting doubt on it yesterday and highlighting the difference between CIA and FBI conclusions. And I think a lot of our listeners who might have been distracted by things like Christmas shopping and, take their babies to see Santa and stuff like that are really confused. So can you unpack for everyone?
Well, yes. What happened is that the intelligence community, both the CIA and the FBI, had concluded previously that Russia had hacked the accounts of the Democratic National Committee and other members of Hillary Clinton's campaign. And their original conclusion as to Russia's motive was that it was to undermine confidence in American democracy. Then, as they looked into it further, they found an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence to lead them to the conclusion that the motive was more than that. It was also to actually help Donald Trump win and hurt Hillary Clinton. So the FBI is a little bit less sure about the second conclusion about the motive. But what's interesting about Donald Trump's reaction is he not only is rejecting this notion that Russia interfered on his behalf, in essence, and you can kind of understand why he's saying that. He doesn't want to accept anything that would undermine his win. And he actually even accused Democrats yesterday of pushing this story to make his victory seem less significant. Now, he won decisively. You could say his victory was even stunning, but not, as he has been saying, it was not a landslide Electoral College victory. He got 306 electoral votes. That ranks him 46 out of 58 elections in our history. Huh. But the other thing he's rejecting, and I think this is more significant, he's not just rejecting the conclusion that the intelligence community has come about why Russia did this. He is rejecting the notion that Russia hacked, period. And he has been doing this all along. He has said he doesn't believe that Russia hacked. He said it could have been anybody. It could have been some guy in New Jersey. He said during one debate it could have been a 400-pound person sitting on his bed. He has rejected the notion that Russia hacked, period. Now, why is he doing that? That's more mysterious. We know he wanted a more friendly relationship with Russia. He's spoken with a lot of affection about Vladimir Putin. He seems to be ready to break with decades of foreign policy consensus about America's role in the world. And he doesn't seem to look at Russian aggression in Europe and around the world with the same kind of alarm as the foreign policy establishment. But beyond that, that part is mystifying. John McCain, who is one of the senators who wants this investigated, who says that the Russian cyber attack should alarm all Americans and that Congress should look into it without it becoming a partisan issue, yesterday on Face the Nation, he said he doesn't know what to make of Trump's comments because he said it's clear the Russians did interfere. So that part is still a mystery. Why is Trump refusing over and over again to take the conclusions of the American intelligence community?
And listeners, if you have anything to say or to ask Mara Lyson about the transition, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And to go further on that, Mara, Trump reminded the world this weekend that the CIA got it wrong on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, leading to that war. Is this another case of Trump just trying to discredit anyone who gets in his way at the moment, and it won't mean anything as soon as it's in his interest to call them great people, fantastic people, like he does now with Romney and Obama? Or are he and the CIA actually starting out with a relationship of mutual distrust?
Well, I would say that he certainly is starting out with a big breach between him and the intelligence community. This is something that's never happened before. You know, during the campaign, he said that he knows more than the generals and the generals have been reduced to rubble. And what was interesting about the comment about the CIA, it didn't come in a tweet. It came in an official statement from the transition. This was something that was thought through. He said the same people who were wrong about weapons of mass destruction. So he really insulted the intelligence community. He went further yesterday on Fox News when he said he doesn't need intelligence briefings every day. It's already been reported that he doesn't take them every day. But he said, quote, "I'm like a smart person and don't need to hear the same words on the same things every day for 8 years." And then he went on to say, "They can call me when there's something new." So what that raises the question is, what happens when the intelligence community comes to him with information about Iran or China or North Korea that doesn't fit into his preconceived assumptions or worldview? Is he just going to dismiss them? And it also tells us that one of the questions that people have been asking about Donald Trump was, as you suggested, are there things he just does when he's campaigning? He's kind of outrageous. He insults people, but he doesn't really mean it and he can change on a dime. Are there two Trumps, a kind of more sober presidential circumspect Trump that will emerge after he becomes president or not? I would say so far the answer is no. what you see is what you get. He said during the campaign that he believes his own brain is his best advisor. Yesterday, he said he doesn't need intelligence briefings, so he's still the same kind of impulsive, incurious person who is resistant to facts. None of those traits have changed. So I think now we have a pretty good idea that the Trump we've seen all along is the real Donald Trump.
Diane in Boonton, you're on WNYC with Mara Liasson. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. Take you off speaker. My question is, I haven't been hearing too much about, in the last 2 or 3 days, about Donald Trump's urging the Russians to hack. And then why is that completely somehow not doesn't count anymore?
Oh, I was just going to
play
that clip.
Oh, I think it counts, and we have been pointing that out, and you're right, and I should have just pointed it out again.
And
as a matter of fact, the last press conference he had, and I don't know if anybody has the count on how many days it's been. Uh-huh. It's been many, 100 and something. But that was the last press conference when he asked the Russians to hack into Hillary's emails.
I think it was July 27th, and I think you're talking about this clip.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
That one, right, Diane?
That's the one.
Yeah, we haven't forgotten about it, Diane.
I just wondered why it didn't come up on Meet the Press yesterday. And the
well, it did.
Thing...
They played it on Meet the Press yesterday. They actually did.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know about the other Sunday shows, but I heard them play it on Meet the Press.
Oh, okay, good. And then the other thing was about why it doesn't, or does it, or does it not seem suspicious that just the Democratic National Committee would have been hacked and not the Republicans?
Well, wait a second. That is an important fact. One of the reasons that the CIA and the intelligence community changed its conclusion about the motive was they got more evidence and they found out that in fact the RNC had been hacked, but that the Russians chose to weaponize only the emails that it got from the Democrats, not the Republicans, although Colin Powell's emails were let out, but mostly to discredit Hillary Clinton. So that is one of the reasons they came to this conclusion, that Russia's motive was to put its thumb on the scale for Donald Trump, not just to undermine confidence in American democracy. And there was a lot of pushback about this notion that Russia had hacked the RNC from Reince Priebus yesterday. When he was interviewed on Meet the Press, because he kept on saying the RNC was not hacked. Now, you know, this might be a term of art. Maybe the Russians tried to get in, got in, but didn't get very far. I don't know. But the intelligence community believes that Russia did hack both parties, but only chose to make public the Democratic emails.
But that was a serious point of contention in that pretty major and extended dust-up between the host of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, and Reince Priebus, incoming chief of staff, yesterday. And Priebus insisted, and I don't know what's true, that they may have breached the RNC computers, but they didn't get information like they got all those John Podesta emails on the Democratic side. Do we know?
Yeah, and I don't really know if that's the case, why that how that helps Trump. I mean, I don't really understand what Reince Priebus is trying to do, except
well, if they didn't have it, then they couldn't have selectively chosen to withhold it.
True, but they did release Colin Powell. They did release some Republican emails when it was in the service of undermining Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So on that clip from July, he can say that one day, Russia, please keep hacking the Democratic Party. And now say he takes our cybersecurity seriously. He'll be president of the United States. If Obama ever said that, John McCain would have started impeachment proceedings. How close to Trump might any investigation of Russian hacks get once it presumably starts in Congress?
Well, that's a really good question. Now, we do have these four, you know, two Republicans and two Democrats in the Senate saying there should be an investigation. We have another Republican senator, James Lankford, saying he thinks it should be investigated. The chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Mike McFaul, also thinks there should be an investigation. So I think it's going to be pretty hard to stop. If Congress wants to look into this, they will. Also, President Obama has asked for an inquiry into cyber attacks to be done by the time he leaves office, which happens to be the day that Trump would be inaugurated. So you're going to have a lot of information about this coming out before Trump is president, and then presumably in the new Congress, there would be more investigations. One of the things that I think that questions will be asked is what did Trump campaign officials know about Russian efforts, because we do know from a Russian official that the Russians were in close contact all throughout the campaign with some of the top campaign officials in the Trump campaign. His former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, worked for pro-Russian Ukrainian government officials, and there are a lot of connections. So maybe, yes, maybe those things will – there will be more light shed on those connections.
Peter in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Brian. How are you? Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
I guess my question is a little deeper. My feeling is the fact that there was a hack by the Russians, which is bad enough, and we should investigate that, and I think this goes on quite a bit. But it was really the content of what we heard, the two faces of Hillary Clinton, the issues with the foundation. It was that information that came out that I think started to turn the election. And the idea of the hack, well, that was the bad. But for me, what turned the election was the content. And I don't hear a lot of digging into all that content and how that really affected the election.
Right. And I don't think that the claim here on anybody's part, and obviously the Democratic Party has an interest in keeping this front and center, because it does, to some degree, discredit Trump. But the content was the content, and the content definitely hurt Hillary Clinton. And except for those outlets that took real content from the Russian hacks of the DNC and turned it into fake news, I mean, those things were reported as real, and they got baked into the fact. But there's the issue of the hacking itself, which is, I guess, what's being raised now. And, Mara, this is, to me, another...
Yeah, I think if Hillary Clinton had won, we'd be talking about the content. Now Donald Trump has won, and we're talking about the hacking.
Yeah.
I mean, one is relevant now, and one is no longer so relevant. She lost.
But she lost. And I don't think the Democrats are trying to say she would have won.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, that's something we should stress. Nobody is saying that this hacking was determinative, whatever Russians might have wanted to do to help Trump, that was the reason he won. No, nobody's saying that. As a matter of fact, as I said earlier, he won. He had a decisive win, and it was stunning. But he seems to be very sensitive about anything that casts any kind of a shadow on it. You know, he keeps on saying he won a historic Electoral College landslide, which just isn't true. And he seems to also be very sensitive about the fact that he lost the popular vote, because, of course, he tweeted erroneously that he would have won the popular vote if millions of people hadn't voted illegally. And we don't know he hasn't produced any evidence for that. Unless he knows something that he's not talking about. And how do we know some of those illegal people didn't vote for him?
Peter, thank you. Keep calling us. Okay, Rex Tillerson. I thought the clip, for people who were listening a few minutes ago, that we played, a glimpse of Tillerson as ExxonMobil CEO, was interesting for a few reasons. One was that Trump has been denouncing the Iran arms deal, denouncing it, but Tillerson seemed to see it in terms of Trump's main concern, economic growth. And you may have heard that clip for the first time, Tillerson from CNBC back in March. But on first impression, might that be an indication that Tillerson could argue for Trump to stay in the Iran deal rather than rip it up on day one, as he is sometimes threatened to do?
Well, sure. And you could find a lot of things where ExxonMobil's interests contradict what Donald Trump has said he would do. I mean, ExxonMobil has invested in clean energy and has not, as Donald Trump said, pushed this notion that climate change is a hoax. You know, there are a lot of ways. But the big question about Tillerson is he fits the model of Trump's view of the world and diplomacy and foreign relations as transactional, you know, making deals. And the question about Tillerson has... He put Exxon, obviously, when he was the head of ExxonMobil, he put the interests of his company ahead of U.S. national security interests sometimes, although he had to abide by all the rules. And when there were sanctions on Russia, he couldn't do certain things. He wanted those sanctions lifted. Donald Trump has talked about lifting those sanctions also. The sanctions that are on Russia
because when they took over Crimea. So, but he also is very friendly with Vladimir Putin. He was given the Russian Order of Friendship Award in 2013, and that is what's raising questions for some Republican senators like John McCain and Marco Rubio, who is on the Foreign Relations Committee and tweeted the other day, being a friend of Vlad is not, or Vladimir is not an attribute I am hoping for from a Secretary of State.
How about the idea behind the Steve Call clip we played and his book, Private Empire, about ExxonMobil as sort of beyond national sovereignty? Would you expect it to be a big issue in confirmation hearings, whether the interests he's made a career of promoting are the same as U.S. interests and where into conflict?
Right. Well, of course. I mean, first of all, if he's nominated, he'll say in his confirmation hearings that what I did as the president of a company would be totally different than what I'm doing representing the United States and all of its interests. But what's interesting is if Donald Trump's view of the national security interests of the United States are very transactional and it's about making deals, we don't know what his principles are. He has yet to talk about what American values are worth defending. He's even called into question whether NATO is worth defending. So when you look at the Trump cabinet, which is shaping up to be full of generals, Wall Street bankers, fossil fuel executives, billionaires, corporate chieftains, it looks very globalist. Not populist, not nationalist. It looks very globalist. And Donald Trump ran explicitly against globalism. And so if he's going to develop this cabinet that some people have called corporate statism, those are some questions that these people are going to be asked. And what we don't know is what Donald Trump feels are the principles of United States national security and our role in the world. For instance, he got a lot of pushback for questioning the one China policy. You know, and he made that call to – he accepted a call and talked on the phone with the president of Taiwan, which made China very angry. But then the very next day, he seemed to say, that Taiwan is just a bargaining chip. And that – it almost undercut –
He said it again yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday. So in other words, in his first impulse to talk to the president of Taiwan fit with the long-standing views of many Republicans and even some Democrats that it's time to get tougher with China. And one way you do that is you show more, you lean in more to Taiwan. But if, as he said in the subsequent days, I think it's just part of a negotiation, that should strike fear into the heart of Taiwan. If he thinks that he can push China to give U.S. better trade deals or do something more with North Korea and Taiwan is just a bargaining chip and then he'll give it up in order to get a better deal from China on trade or something else, that's a real, real break with decades and decades of bipartisan foreign policy consensus about America's role in the world.
And that would be more consistent with Trump's style, because coming in as an America First president, that means just bargaining for the U.S.'s interests, not trying to promote democracy around the world as a principle, which is usually the reason that Americans back up Taiwan to any degree.
Right. And look, you know, the United States until November 9th was the only superpower in the world that stood up for democratic values and ideals and defended its allies who were like-minded. Now that's all been called into question. And we don't know what Donald Trump wants to do. We don't know exactly how he sees America's role in the world, although he has described it as being very transactional, America first. You know, he's called into question America's commitment to NATO. And that's why the day after Election Day, you saw these headlines in Europe, the West, the end of the West. You know, the West, the idea of the West has died. So I think that his pick for Secretary of State is really, really important, because don't forget, Mitt Romney is still considered to be on the short list for this. He hasn't made a final decision. Mitt Romney represented a very different view. He famously said that Russia was America's number one geopolitical foe. So we still don't have a clear idea of Donald Trump's approach to foreign policy.
Michael in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. You know, you two ought to be ashamed of yourselves by promoting this fake news of Russia did this and Russia did that. You have not cited one iota of evidence other than this mantra of anonymous sources in the CIA. I mean, do you people want a war with Russia? Is that what you want?
So when the CIA, and it's reported in multiple news organizations.
And it's not just the CIA, it's 17 intelligence agencies.
comes out with
and
a report.
And the FBI, which agrees on the fact that Russia hacked, even if they might not agree so much on the motives.
So this is important because it gets back to the previous caller who said the Democrats are hyping this, which they are for their own purposes. But the reason that this is news right now is that the CIA chose to start leaking, and we can talk about why they've leaked it anonymously instead of...
Well, no, they didn't leak it anonymously. They briefed numerous elected officials.
So
and that's where those reports came from. It isn't the CIA just leaking this and they haven't told anybody about it. They briefed numerous senators and congressmen. And the White House.
So what? Because that was part of the Reince Priebus pushback on Meet the Press yesterday, too, that this was just based on anonymous sources that Times
this is classified
was quoting
information
from the CIA. Should the CIA director maybe hold a news conference to stop this part of the pushback?
I don't know. The CIA is in a very interesting position, the whole intelligence community is, because you've got an incoming president who does not want to accept their findings unless it fits into his, agenda. And that raises questions about what happens when they come and tell him about something they think is happening in North Korea or China or Russia or any other bad actor around the world.
So how much does the structure of government guarantee that the CIA will be independent in its intelligence assessments? This was one of the questions with the Bush CIA before the war. And how much can Trump decide to politicize it if, say, he doesn't want negative findings about Russia to be made public?
I think he has a lot of control over that. If he doesn't want to, I think he has a lot of control over that. On the other hand, the intelligence community is filled with professionals who try to do the best job they can, who don't have a political agenda. Sometimes they get things wrong. And don't forget, there has to be they give information to elected officials, and then those officials have to interpret it. And there, during the run-up to the Iraq War, there was pushback in the intelligence community about weapons of mass destruction. So I think to totally dismiss and undermine and our intelligence capability, filled with people who actually have, you know, given their lives for the country, is something wholly unprecedented. And I can just tell you, it's sending shivers down the spines of many national security professionals in Washington.
Brian in Ocean Township on the possible appointment of Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO, as Secretary of State. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to address this terminology your guest used, globalist appointments. I mean, of course, the Carl Jr.'s appointment doesn't seem globalist.
I agree with that. That's fair. Carl Jr., certainly not.
The head of the that fast food company.
But I would say Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil, those are pretty globalist.
Absolutely. And I thought Tillerson, and I'm a Bernie, you know, Democrat, and I voted for Hillary, but I thought Tillerson's comments were actually quite intelligent. And if I was Trump, the only thing I would worry about domestically for my reelection and for the midterms would be reading that New York Times article yesterday about the so-called moderate Democrats worried about holding onto their seats and basically focusing on Trump's populism and whether he's going to deliver on those populist promises to keep jobs and to take care of a working class, which I don't think anyone can deny has been abandoned by both parties. So I see the globalist superstructure. But I'm just pointing out that the populist structures in his political thinking and his political campaign have got to be protected by him, or he's really opening up the way that kind of Tip O'Neill opened up Ronald Reagan. Tip O'Neill, his strategy was basically let him go and try to destroy Social Security, let him go and you know, be anti-women and anti-abortion, and he will dig his own grave.
Well, except for Tip O'Neill controlled the House. I mean, there was divided government back then.
Right.
And there's not now. But I think you raise a really important point. The big question is, who among these cabinet appointments are going to push policies that are going to help the working class? We don't know yet. We know that the Labor Secretary appointment is against raising the minimum wage and doesn't believe in certain sick leave policies. We know that the tax plan is heavily weighted to the affluent voters. Actually, probably more Hillary Clinton voters will benefit from the tax plan as it's currently written than Donald Trump's base. So, yeah, I think that's exactly the thing to watch for.
So as we start to run out of time, how are the Democrats reacting to the cabinet picks? Are they looking to pick one or two to go after and try to deny? Or are they going to put up a blizzard of dissent to everything in a posture of general resistance to Trumpism? Or what can you say?
Well, I don't think they've decided that yet. I think some of these candidates are going to be much easier for them to oppose than others. I think that the only way that any of these candidates are going to not be confirmed is if three Republicans, you know, join in and vote no. I thought it was interesting that there was so much pushback against Tillerson. And, you know, he might be a trial balloon. He hasn't been named yet.
Mm-hmm. All right. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson giving us the privilege of one-on-one after you heard her on Morning Edition today, probably, and all the time on the network for the whole nation, coming with us here on WNYC for this half hour. Mara, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, is subway service getting worse, or does it just seem that way? Stay with us.